Okay, so obviously we brought up some pretty controversial types of therapeutic strategies. The field of stem cell biology has matured, and we've got into the clinic. We were talking about being teenagers at the stage we're at. It's kind of like driving a car when you're a teenager. You think you can do it, but you're not quite sure how well you can do it, and hopefully you don't have too many passengers. But things can work out very well, as we just saw from Stephen and Nicholas and Dean, so I think we've got some tremendous opportunities. One question I had was comparing to standard of care. So when we do phase one clinical trials, there's no comparison. You know, you get into phase two trials with adherent stem cells, and there you're really looking at dose ranging studies. Phase three, you're looking at how does it do compared to standard of care. So I just wanted to ask our panelists, starting with Stephen Schwartz, about how this new strategy to replace the RPE compares to standard of care. And I ask that because it's such a small world. My microbiology thesis was on photosensitizers, and my thesis was part of the IND for Visudyne.
Visudyne, right? So anyway, and patented it. But that's another. This was kind of a quick presentation, and one of the slides I left out is these are unmet medical needs, completely untreatable conditions. So Stargardt's, no treatment. One or two therapeutics have sort of theoretical possibilities that have been in and out of the clinic a little bit. But nothing much for Stargardt's. It's sort of an orphan disease. It's not super prevalent. Age-related macular degeneration, dry. I would say, there's nothing approved. The National Institutes of Health, the National Eye Institute, has sponsored a couple of trials looking at vitamins and micronutrients called the age-related eye disease formulation. You see them on TV during football games about, lutein and zeaxanthin and vitamin commercials. It's a nutraceutical behemoth of a business, but there's nothing to treat at all, so it's a totally unmet need.
You're getting into places where your unmet medical needs as well. How has your strategy worked?
I think our entry strategy in ulcerative colitis was to go into patients that had failed both first and second line standard of care. And so the approach is clearly to go into very high risk patients and demonstrate an efficacious response and then plan to move back to patients that have failed only frontline and then go. I think in the GVHD space, both Osiris and others have gone forward to first treat steroid refractory disease. You're going into patients that have failed all other standard of care and then move back in to treat use the cells as frontline treatment.
Dr. Boulos, your data were very interesting as well, and it was exciting to watch your videos. How do you feel about the stem cells on steroids, as Dr. Schwartz alluded to, or the need for immunosuppression in this setting and perhaps lightening that immunosuppression?
Well, I think it's highly likely that we're going to be going to less aggressive immunosuppressant regimens. Number one, because we're learning from this trial that all ALS patients don't tolerate this kind of a regimen. Number two, because having faced these issues, we're now rigorously going back and trying to study this in animal models. What we're doing is we're actually trying to use iPS cells to create allografts for pigs and then study how the allografts behave and optimize immunosuppression regimens. Getting into a little bit more detail with this, in Martin's diagram, he had a picture of injecting the cervical cord and the lumbar cord. Well, you can't really do that in one sitting, or if you do, that's a lot of anesthesia for an already compromised patient. So you're really forced to do staged operations, do one, then come back and do the other. But we're not entirely sure whether injecting the stem cells the first time sensitizes the immune system for the second injection. So this is another area that we have to study. And durability, do you have to just immunosuppress in the first part and then can you withdraw? So these are all questions that we're studying in the most rigorous way possible now. And we're going to apply those going forward. And then finally, as I said, two of our patients have died. This is a terminal disease, which makes it attractive to study in the sense that we can actually look at the cords. We can't see our retinal pigment epithelial cell layer. That's a huge advantage of your disease process. But our patients die, so we are getting their spinal cords back, and we can look and try and look for cell survival and look at the patients who had to stop immunosuppression versus lymphoma.
The other advantage is that we're putting in 150 microliters, and you're putting in
Not too dissimilar. It's 10 microliters per injection, 50 microliters per side, total of 100 microliters. Yeah.
The reason you do it slowly is you don't want separation?
Our concern was that pressure is bad for the spinal cord. So we wanted to make sure there's as little pressure as possible. Two, we wanted to reduce reflux because, you know, if you go quickly, the cells just wick right back up the needle and come out. It's interesting that that doesn't happen, but I get the sense that a photoreceptor layer actually forms almost a seal there, and there's a precedent for you guys raising blebs there. That there's no space, potential space for those cells to occupy, so they're going to want to come out. But I think the issue of trying dose range and get to higher volumes is going to be critical. We may need to be at much higher cell concentrations as well.
And one last question, the potential for tumorigenicity we talked about last night, how do you mitigate against that?
In our trial? We're using fetal-derived neural progenitors, and in fact, most of the agendas that I listed up there are starting with those. Those really have a very good track record for not forming hamartomas. I think to the extent that we begin to work with embryonic stem cell derivatives, like in the Geron case, I think if anything, that was the major hurdle, showing that you could go forward with an embryonic derivative in a space like the spinal cord, which is really not going to tolerate the formation of a hamartoma. Mm-hmm. And so one of the, there was just a blip there at the end when I said practical issues include fail-safe switch. It seems to me that, I was jealous when I was watching the diabetes talk, because anything that's put in an encapsulated entity could be easily, theoretically, removed. We have no good way to remove these cells if they get out of line. And I think that that's something that needs to be pondered, whether you can genetically modify these cells to have a failsafe switch where you could turn on something that would kill them.
So my perspective on this is, Kat, is what you said. We were talking about this last night. Get it right. Make sure your cells are pure. Make sure their tumorigenicity is low. Don't forget that these are people under the knife, and you want to make sure you're doing right by them. On the other hand, these are heroes because they know clearly that it's unlikely that they're going to experience improved vision or improved function. They're really doing it to further the field. And so you have to have a huge amount of respect, get it right the first time. For us in the eye, we can see them. We've looked like crazy. For anything escaping, have had really zero evidence of it. But we can use a laser and just kill off anything we need to kill off. Or, God forbid, if it was a malignancy forming in the eye, we could take the eye out without much loss to the patient other than psychological, because they're not seeing anyway. But there's just not a hint of inflammation or tumorigenicity at all.
So I'd just like react to the point about get it right the first time. I largely agree, but I think one of the things about this whole clinical translation point is it seems to me that whenever you embark on going to the clinic, by the time you actually get there through all these regulatory stages, it is almost certain that the technology will have matured further. And by the time you're doing what you're doing, you're going to be wishing you did it with something else. I think to a certain extent, you have to make that decision a little bit on the basis of the disease you're dealing with. In our disease, patients are dying. So I think the decision to go forward with the clinical trial it was appropriate, and we're going to learn a lot from it, and the next one's going to be better.
I think that's a great point.
Yeah. And also with the tumorigenicity part, I think as we learn from the CIRM-funded and even non-CIRM-funded work, that we can interrupt these cancer stem cells if it's cancer stem cells at the root of the tumorigenic process, or these primitive stem cells that have co-opted the self-renewal capacity through these other targeted therapies. So I wanted to open it up for questions from the floor. Larry always has good questions. I could see that.
Oh, can you hear me now? So I'm particularly wondering for the non-spinal cord surgeries. Sorry, Nick, you're out on this one. About the issue of time. So how long do you follow the patients if you put cells into an individual with a non-lethal disease? How long are they part of a trial, and how long do you follow them up?
14 years.
Okay. Can you explain that?
Sure. That's the number that the agency and the investigators agreed upon.
And the logic?
Oh, now. We didn't go to logic. Listen, I did some of the first gene therapy studies in humans back in the day when we were using adenovirus. Not AAV, but actual adenovirus in the eye. And we're still trying to track a few of those patients down, you know, years and years later. Their eyes long gone, whatever. It's just part of the bargain of translational science. You just have to follow them, essentially, forever. The AMD patients are over 65, so we're going to be following them well into their 80s. The Stargardt's patients are between, to be end stage enough to be eligible for this phase one, they're between 45 and 60, and we're going to be following them for a long time. The endpoints of the trial, we're not going to be doing what we're doing to them right now in the first 6 months and then the first year. And we're certainly not going to wait 14 years to apply for a phase two if things go as we're hoping and so on. And I'm apologize for sort of skirting outcome issues because I don't want to say anything out of turn here. That's really it. I mean, the logical thing is look at them, see if there's engraftment, see if there's any functional signal, see if there's any safety signal. And that's what we're doing. And I can say certainly at 4 months there is zero safety signal. And I would love to tell you some more, but I'll be struck by something if I do.
And with a with a private sector driven trial, where is the company? You know, is a company necessarily going to be around in 14 years?
That's a great
UCLA
question.
UCLA will still be here.
Well, I might not be. Listen, I've inherited as chief of the retina division and a professor that has a number of people working under me and a number of people who are, you know, gone to Michigan or gone to Harvard or gone wherever or gone to Scripps. There are lots of clinical trials that I inherit. Some of it is true detritus that I just think of as a nightmare, and some of it's really interesting. And we have to and get to watch these patients. Some of it we have to keep their records forever. We have to watch them forever. It's part of our mission of research. It's the long haul. But it's not that hard to do when you realize it's people, and it could just as easily be me or my family member who needs this information. We do learn from following these patients. And I made the point, and you all know this better than I do, these are dynamic, complex, biological therapeutics that could do virtually anything at any time, as far as I'm concerned. So it would be negligent and wrong and probably immoral, certainly unethical, to say, okay, you're fine, hit the road, you had your stem cells, you know, giddy up, six months down the road, next. You know, we can't do that.
Kat, there's one up here.
One of the things that wasn't standardized in the Geron trial was the anesthetics. The anesthesiologist did whatever they wanted. And anesthetics are not inert in these cells, especially developing cells. And I'm wondering if any of you are taking the time to compare the relative toxicity of the anesthetics and standardizing that across your trials.
Well, so I guess toxicity can refer to toxicity to the cells versus toxicity to the patients. We're still struggling to quantify cell survival for some of the reasons that we've described. I think that there's food for thought there. I will admit that while I have a dedicated infectious disease person in the trial and a dedicated intensivist and I pretty much have every single niche dedicated on this trial with somebody who's an expert. We don't actually have neuroanesthesiologists at Emory for some strange reason, and I'm still panhandling to find somebody who will dedicate themselves to this, so that's a weakness.
That's a great question. We actually don't need anesthesia for eye surgery. You know, we just need a little Valium and propofol and lidocaine, and it's not that much. We just have it in the room, really.
I have a question for Dr. Deans about the characterization of these adult stem cells. You know, we certainly imagine that they're going to be heterogeneous at some level within PrEP and across PrEP. And then also when you have so many different indications and, you know, maybe a little bit unclear mechanism of action, how much work goes into that? You know, the ISCT has this kind of very broad definition of an MSC. I don't know if you follow that kind of idea, but what much more detail needs to be developed about the relationship between particular cell subpopulations and a given therapeutic indication?
Yeah, I think each company is doing much more detailed analytical analysis of the cell product than you're seeing in publications. And so we compare clinical campaign runs with every molecular tool we have. We look at transcriptional profiling, you know, changes in gene methylation pattern. We use CGH or SNP analysis to know that we've got a stable cytogenetic analysis. We've done comparative transcriptional profiling to distinguish ourselves from an MSC or an adherent product from another source. We have specific antibody markers or qPCR-based strategies that tell us how many of our cells, if any, have drifted over to that phenotype. So I, at least from our side, more knowledge is best. And we certainly apply potency assays driven around mechanistic pathways, and those are assays that start out preclinically, that we take them apart in vitro. We do knockdown experiments to show the factors are required and necessary for the activity, and we do add-back experiments, and then we analyze those in our clinical production campaigns. So I don't think you can develop your process from a benchtop expansion protocol to a commercial scale if you don't have very tight analysis of the cell product. So you're identifying a really key point.
Okay, and then one last question.
Okay. I just wanted to ask the panelists your idea about the concept of the valley of shadow, the death valley. I know to a certain extent we just sort of assume that has to be that size, but it isn't that way in all countries. For instance, you know, there was a bone marrow-derived stem cell product for acute MI that was approved in Korea by their regulatory agency this July. And if you look at their data, it was very small compared to the data that has to be submitted to the U.S. FDA. So I'd like to you to comment about, have we created too large of a valley to get these products approved? The second related issue that I think has been missed is just in the last few weeks, there was a free trade association agreement made between the U.S. and Korea, where the U.S. FDA and the Korean FDA are now going to share data and develop a common standard for what they will accept in this area. It's going to take several years for this to be implemented, but I would like your opinion about whether we can start collaborating with regulatory agencies in other countries to help bridge this valley.
I don't think the solution is to shortcut the quality of the clinical study design. And I worry quite a bit about differences in standard of care in global clinical markets. And so, you know, I think that there are very competent hospitals and physicians that can practice your therapeutic delivery. I think variability in patient follow-up is going to contribute to clinical data scatter. And I'm concerned about the complexity of managing, non-traditional clinical studies in that regard. I think the other solution relates to where capital comes into the process. And capital's not coming in because we don't know enough about how the cells are working, how to apply them to convince pharma and healthcare to invest. And I think to a degree it's a partnership between industry supporting the excellent bench science and preclinical and translational work that can get done at regenerative medicine centers. And I think groups like the MESA, groups like WFIRM and CIRM can do a lot to advance our knowledge around these therapies to bring investment capital in at an earlier stage. It's really the key. And I think learning how to dialogue between industry and the academics and build trustful relationships is critical. We've got to do this with open development, shared clinical data registries, and, you know, acknowledgement of what doesn't work as much as what does.
I would echo that a lot. I've had, you know, I would say more than my share of interaction with the FDA and some with CMS, and I have nothing but positive things to say about the FDA. They have a really, really hard job. They have to not stifle innovation and deal with unmet needs, and they have to protect the public first. And they do a really thorough, good job. They are underpaid, overworked, and doing a great, great job. And I'm talking about not just in ophthalmology, but I've worked with them at gene therapy and now cell, and I can tell you that I am nothing but impressed. I'm grumbly when I get back 40 pages of correspondence, and a lot of it I think is junk, but I still think they're doing it, and they're learning, and they want me to teach them. That's fine. What I'd love to see them do is rather than share information with Korea, nothing against Korea, I'd like them to share information with the National Institute of Health. I'd like them to be able to pick up the phone and call Dr. Rao and say, is this what? You know, come on. And then that's what I want. It's like FDA and CMS don't talk.
Yeah.
You look at the organizational chart of health and human services in our country, the National Institute of Health is one of, I don't know, 28 little boxes on that org chart that all report to the same Undersecretary of Health and Human Services that has to co-sign, you know, $200 billion worth of every year. It's shocking and appalling. But what I need is crosstalk across those boxes. Because down the street at NIH, these guys are deconflicted of everything. I don't think I can take him out for a beer. I mean, if I can, I'd be happy to. But I, you know, and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I would love for them to talk to each other, not with Korea. I with all due respect to Korea or Brazil, I've run international clinical trials. This is, and I do not want to sound anything but patriotic. This is the only country in the world where you're supposed to be able to drink water out of every tap, and we should be able to trust our medicines also. And FDA.
I think some of that dialogue is happening. We had a phase two STTR and traumatic brain injury that required us to bring the preclinical evaluation from the FDA into the granting review process. So they weren't willing to fund the translational work unless they knew we had buy-off from the FDA. So it's obviously done with
it's coming.
Yeah.
That said, I think I'm also in the clinical trials study section. So. I mean, I would echo what you're saying, that I think that one of the big problems in the academic process is the fact that, you know, you have to go through that peer review process to get the funding. That's gonna generate a number of criticisms that beget revisions. And then the regulatory process is also gonna beget revisions. And you know, if you actually track, you know, the number of hurdles you have to go through, it is not unusual for you to make a change from the way you started to address one person's concern, and then somebody else comes along with another concern. You undo it in the process, and I think this can be streamlined, and I think it can particularly be streamlined for orphan diseases. I mean, I think.
It is.
Yeah. Right. Well,
it is streamlined for orphan diseases. The numbers, the bars are much lower. You know, look at Alexion with their paroxysmal, whatever it is, the black urine disease.
PNH. Paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobin.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't have to study many patients at all.
That's right.
So they lower the bar in some places and not in others. But I would be very strongly against. I'm all for streamlining. I'm all for information sharing domestically. But let's get our own house in order first before we start trading clinical data with, you know, everybody.
So speaking of getting our house in order, I think this has been a great discussion. We're clearly talking about streamlining, collaborating, and moving forward with stem cell-related clinical trials. This is very exciting to see real clinical data that's come from stem cell research. Thank you for taking it on as the champions and allowing the patients to benefit. We're going to take a break till 4:45, and then we'll have our last keynote speaker.